that kind of leads us to what the actual fundamental biggest cost of the whole thing is, and it's actual depreciation. Mm-hmm. It's not depreciation for tax reasons. It's not depreciation for my banker, which is usually pretty conservative. It's actual depreciation. So what is this thing going to be worth or likely to be worth in the next 5 years when I go to sell it? Yield always wins in this. And so understanding your efficiencies and the agronomic gains that you have make this a really smart decision when you're thinking about equipment. It can't be emotional. It can't be this or that. What are the gains you think you can have? And then let's put the pencil to it and let's make the right decision.
Ladies and gentlemen, farmers, ranchers, and distinguished guests, thank you for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast, where we discuss the latest ideas, methods, trends, and techniques available to help your farm achieve higher levels of farm profitability. The Farm for Profit podcast is co-hosted by Tanner Winterhoff, the Iowa Bankerman, and David Whitaker, the Iowa Land Guy, where in tandem, they will share their ideas and advice from industry experts. Thank you again for listening to the Farm for Profit podcast. Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long. And now, here's Tanner and David.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of the Farm for Profit podcast. This is Tanner Winterhoff.
This is Corey Hillebo.
And this is David Whitaker.
And again, thank you for reminding us that we should share with you each time that I'm the ag lender, banker.
I am the farmer, Corey.
And I am the auctioneer, realtor, David.
There you go. So now you got unique perspectives that come from these topics that you guys share with us. And we thank you for doing that, for sending them to farmforprofitllc@gmail.com. We also really appreciate the reviews that you leave behind for liking this podcast and sharing it with your friends. So keep that up. Keep doing that for us. We appreciate that.
And we have a listener review today, and it's brought by one of our partners, BW Fusion. They're focused on bringing innovative fertility, nutritional, and technology to the ag marketplace. They combine the best-in-class products along with 365 soil and tissue program to provide growers the tools necessary to address limiting factors in real time. And truly, your reviews show how much we monitor the marketplace in real time.
That's how we know if we're doing a good job or not.
And how we know they're doing a good job is because Corey is using their product as well.
That's right.
And Corey is given he's going to give a real life review on it once he puts the combine through the field.
Yeah, I was going to say, you shouldn't probably do everything that I do just because I do it. But we are going to, for sure, take the results and check them out.
But Corey is not our review today. Who's our review today?
Our review is by the original BTO.
Oh, the original.
We've got competition in our review people.
I guess. Our original BTO says, Tanner, Corey, and David make a great team and do a great job integrating a variety of topics into their podcast. If you're passionate about agriculture, you'll enjoy their show.
All right.
That's very nice. That was a very nice review.
That came with another 5-star review. So great. Thank you to the original BTO.
Yeah. Who do you think that is?
I don't know.
Is that Taylor Sumption?
Ooh, that could be.
That Q.
No, I can't believe that.
Q can't be every week's review. No,
maybe he is. Maybe we only have one listener.
He just keeps making a new name.
We just have one listener leading us a lot of different reviews. No, yeah. Thank you so much for doing that. Remember, this is a Farm for Profit show. So now we're going to roll into a What's Working in Ag segment, followed by a general topic to help your farm make more money. And next week will be the Farm for Fun show. Also, thank you. Welcome on board to Estes Concaves for supporting this podcast here pre-harvest. They want to remind you that their concaves are top of the line. They continue to work with their engineers and design to make sure that you basically stop rotor loss, period, Corey.
Mm-hmm. And the quality of the crop coming out in your grain tank, going into your bins, is superb. It's the XPR2 concaves is what they're talking about.
That's right. We like partners like this, Dave, where we can put a number to the savings. Like, we are farm for profit, and when there is something that we can add to our existing equipment lineup to help us make more profit, that's why it seems to run nice parallel.
Yeah.
And all grain one concave, correct?
That's correct. You can do all of it with the one set. So that's EstesPerformanceConcaves.com. So go check them out. Awesome. So now it's time to roll into our What's Working in Ag segment today. Really fun to have a guest in studio. Don't get to do that very often. I've got Hans Rasmussen here as a part of Brandt. Welcome.
Thanks for having us here.
How are you doing today?
Just fine with this nice weather.
Yeah, no kidding. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, what your role is, and how you've got there?
I'm Hintz Rasmussen. I'm the regional sales manager for the Midwest Northeast part of the U.S., along with the Eastern Canada. Been with Brandt coming up on 4 years.
Nice.
Based out of our Illinois facility, and that's how I ended up being with Brandt, is Brandt acquired that facility from the company I was with previously, and I was too lazy to move my desk, so I just stayed.
I like that. I need to employ that a little bit more often with what I've got going on. Yeah. So say that again. You were the West, Northwest region?
No, Northeast and the Midwest.
Northeast and Midwest. So today we are here specifically talking about the Green Cart product that Brandt has to offer in our What's Working in Ag segment. So that's what we've got today for you listeners as a What's Working in Ag feature. And this is the XT series, correct?
Yes, it is. It's XT, which is our single logger. It was a new series we developed and introduced last year in limited and this year in full version. And it's quite unique in the way we do our design work. Brandt does what we call a customer advisory group, CAG for short.
Yeah.
And what we do is we bring in farmers from all over to give input. And in this case here, we brought in several farmers to meetings in Illinois. And then we had our carts, our competitor carts, and we asked the farmers to go through and, what do you like? What don't you like? What's missing? What would you like to have? And then we came back a few months later with some preliminary ideas, drawings, to show those same farmers. The next step was we actually showed a prototype after some more refinements. And so that process is something we do on all our products. But particularly the grain cart was the first Midwest developed product like that. And so there's some features that farmers here in the Midwest really appreciate.
That's cool. So, but this isn't the first grain cart that Brandt has made. You've just had dual auger carts prior to this, correct?
No, we've had both before, but this is the first one that we've basically rebuilt from a clean shade of paper.
Oh, well, that's exciting. I'm sure with the advisory group's input that you've kind of got some industry-leading features as a part of this XT series.
That's correct. We have the longest reach. If you're sitting in a tractor, instead of looking back over your shoulder, now you're looking straight out at the spout that is in front of you instead of behind you. We are 8 feet from the hitch pin forward to where the auger unloads, which is the longest in the industry, plus also the longest in height. And we're trying to keep in mind operator ease, and that's what some of the farmers were pushing us for. Not only the reach and the visibility where it is, but everybody, if you've driven a grain cart, you're always looking to see where you're at with the flow gate, how much is left in the tank. And you're looking at the truck and your eyes are bouncing back and forth and spillage can occur. So what we did to help compensate that is we put a series of LED lights on the spout.
Oh, no kidding.
And that way, if your flow gate is all the way open, all the lights are lit up, so the operator has a good indicator.
Just by glancing.
Just looking at the spout and watching the truck, never taking his eyes off, he knows where he's at. So if the truck is filling up and all his lights are lit up, maybe it's time to start closing the gate. And he can do that all from the joystick and not take his eyes off the truck.
That's always something that I've wanted to try using, is setting up a joystick. Because it seems like I get stuck in that role, either running a semi or the grain cart on operations. And it is really kind of seems backwards to have your controls on the right hand side and that auger coming out your left. It'd be handy to have that joystick that you might be able to move around with you.
Yeah, and it is like even with the prototype, I operated one myself, and not being an expert, it was easy to adjust to using, where before you kind of have to be a bit of a juggler because you've got your right hand running manual controls on that side of the tractor. You're looking out the left side. You're looking over your shoulder to see where the gate is.
Yep.
It's a contortion effort.
Yeah.
This way here, you look at the spout. You hold the joystick in your hand, and you operate everything from there.
That's pretty good. The other thing that I like about this partnership with Brandt and what we've explored from the beginning of these advertisements is the durability of your products. And I'm assuming that that's something that you have also transferred into this XT series grain cart.
Yes, with heavier flighting in the auger, that's the main wear point.
Yep.
In the gearbox, and we've gone to a 2-year warranty on the grain carts as well. which is also an industry-leading feature.
Well, that's handy. That's nice to have a little extra safety net behind. And, you know, you never want to take and put that first dent into a brand new piece of equipment, but at least you know the mechanicals and the wear parts are going to be under warranty for, you know, longer than your competition, like you said.
Yeah.
The other thing that I saw in the pictures is you've done some advancements on how to clean out and service the carts too.
Yeah, and again, here in the Midwest, the farmers are bouncing back and forth between soybeans and corn during harvest. And even some farmers are growing seed beans. And so you want to make sure you completely clean out the cart if you're going from one crop to another or from one farm to another if you're doing organics. And so it's important to be able to clean it out easily. Everybody else, you climb up over the top with a ladder, and then you're down into the tank of the cart, and you're in there cleaning it out, and then it's like you're slipping and crawling trying to get back out again. And so we decided to come out with a rear access door.
Oh, yeah.
And so you can stand on the ground, open this door from the back, take three steps up, and you enter the bin or the tank at floor level. And you can go in and do whatever clean out or maintenance you need to do and come right back out again without having to crawl out over the top.
Yeah, we've done some high moisture corn in the past, and even just wanting to get that cart completely cleaned out so we don't mold up and get stuck and, you know, backed up inside, that would have been really handy had we had one of these Brandt XT carts.
Yeah, and it's very important, especially guys, like I say, with seed beans and you're changing fields, varieties all the time.
Right.
To be able to go in and clean easily, frequently, is a big feature. And again, it was something is our engineering people weren't thinking about, but it was a farmer idea, and it has gone over very well.
That's pretty cool, because a lot of our shows, Hans, are put together by our listeners who are farmers. They're the ones that suggest the topics that we attack and go after. So that's really cool that Brandt has put together a community of farmers to help design and move forward their products, not just in the grain cart side, but in all of the surfaces. So, but what's awesome about these carts is they're made right here in the USA.
Yeah, these are made in Hudson, Illinois, a small town just north of Bloomington in central Illinois.
Awesome. That's fantastic. So it sounds like to me with the Brandt XT grain cart series, not only are we getting an extremely efficient grain cart, it's extra durable, like you said, built to Brandt standards from the beginning. That's a huge factor. It's got some unique features on how you can get into the tank, service, clean it out. The lights that we mentioned for ease of use, operator comfort, comes with that extended warranty that is industry leading.
Yeah.
And again, they're made right here in the U.S. Did I miss anything?
Yeah, it's also we do, which is kind of unique, our powder paint system. We do a two coat. One is a powder primer. And then we do a top coat, what's called top coat powder, of whatever color on the top of that. And so that gives you a longer salt spray hour test.
Nice.
You're going to have something that looks good several years down the road.
No, that's perfect. Well, for our listeners today, if they have questions about XT grain carts or they want to get a hold of somebody to possibly see one in action or see if they can get a hold of one, what's the best way for them to go and look it up?
Probably the best is just go to our website, brandt.ca, and look in, and there's a dealer locator, and you can plug in your address, and it'll come up with the address of the closest dealer.
No, that is awesome. Well, thank you again, Hans, for being a part of this, for jumping in. Thank you to Brandt for their continued partnership of the Farm for Profit podcast. It seems like a match made in heaven, if you want to use a cliche, but we're really happy to be a part of that.
Well, we're glad to be part of it as well, so good luck.
Awesome. Thanks for this What's Working in Ag segment. Now, listeners, we're going to move on to our general topic for the week. So this was a listener suggestion. Andrew Duff emailed us, farmforprofitllc@gmail.com, and he said, you know what? Could you do a show that compares buying new equipment versus repairing old, what the cost of tech upgrades are on older equipment, or justifying an equipment purchase versus owning the equipment compared to custom hiring? So a lot in this email. He said, thank you so much, and continue to keep up the good work. I really liked your Stubborn Farmers episode. So this came in right after our Stubborn Farmers show.
It's very recent.
Very recent. So let's see if we can do that, Dave.
Tanner, we got a fantastic guest today that's going to help us unpack whether you should buy new equipment, maybe some data behind it, old leasing, custom hire. I know we've even talked about this just in a pickup ride of what you should do. So our guest today is TJ Masker with Tractor Zoom, and TJ's senior project manager on the product team at Tractor Zoom. He's helping build farmer-focused solutions. If you guys don't know what Tractor Zoom is yet, take a look. Go out, Google it, type in TractorZoom.com, you'll learn a little bit more. He graduated from Iowa State with an ag business degree, and for the past 10 years of his career, he's focused on helping farmers make more profitable decisions. What a great guy to have on a Farm for Profit podcast.
Like a match made in heaven.
It's like a match made in heaven. And he's making those decisions just like we do with data, Tanner. That's kind of how it's going. So, TJ, welcome.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, like David mentioned, you know, I spent the last 10 years helping farmers with data. And one of the things that I always like to say is that, unfortunately, I don't have the ability to farm, grew up on a farm, but I get to do the next best thing, which is talk to farmers about decisions they're making. Started on the agronomy side of things, moved into the business side of things, and now really focused on equipment. And when you think about equipment as that second highest line item on that balance sheet, we have to be really focused here in what's likely to be a higher profit year. The decisions we make this year will impact the coming years tremendously.
So I like where he's coming from. That the banker in me likes exactly what he just said.
I was going to say,
forget about that. The decisions we make in the profitable years will affect you for years to come.
Well, TJ's been doing this for a long time, like he said, and I actually will vouch for him because I've worked with him in his previous jobs.
Mm-hmm.
TJ actually walked onto our farm with a friend of the show, Premier Crop, Premier Growers.
Okay,
that takes agronomic data and makes your farm more profitable. Then went to Granular, doing some of the same stuff, continuing to snowball his knowledge. Now he went on to Tractor Zoom. So doing the same stuff, he keeps doing great things. I'll vouch for him on that.
And friend of the podcast.
Yeah, I've been listening to you guys for quite some time, and hopefully I have baby number two showing up any day here now. We'll get back to making beer, and maybe one day some of my beer will be featured on the Farm for Fun.
There you
podcast.
Go.
Yeah, I think that would be great. So let's jump right into this. Where do we even start with this email that I got from Andrew? How do you think we should approach making these decisions?
Yeah, it's a really great question. My first 30 days with the team here at Tractor Zoom, I talked to about 50 farmers. And one of the things that there was an intense focus on is, okay, how do we approach making this decision? And the first place you need to start is where the efficiencies can be made on your farm. So understanding where the bottlenecks are and trying to understand wants versus needs. And I get that's very cliche to talk about, but when you understand the needs of an operation, that is critical to helping streamline that purchase. So yeah, maybe I want to upgrade combines, but what if I spent that same dollar amount invested in a drying system, for example, that allows me to get out there earlier and capitalize on that grain? So all of these, every decision has an opportunity cost. So let's identify what the true needs of the operation are first and then go from there.
So yeah, you're really diving into what the goals are of this operation. We need to have a focused approach on our farm. Well, Cajun said, you got to make that shopping list, mm-hmm. you know, and make sure that everybody on your team agrees what's on your shopping list before we look at finding out if it's a want, a need, or what you can actually get for additional revenue out of this.
But I want new parts because I heard on Farm for Profit that I can make more. So I need new equipment, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that's really hard to do is to not compare yourself to the neighbors. How can we get it to where it's a data-driven decision and we're not upgrading just because the neighbors are doing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the things that I've seen really successful farms do is really understand exactly what they're trying to do and the timelines to do them in. So let's say, for instance, that you're going into the spring and you know you only have so many days to plant or get ready. You know, one of the things that I think in the past you'd say, well, farmers are over-equipped or have 50% more planting capacity than they need. And the reality is the suitable days for working in the state of Iowa have gone down over the last 50 years. And so, again, I think it's really a base understanding of exactly what you're trying to get done in the timeline that you have. And when you understand that, that can lead to a better decision. Say, hey, you know, instead of this 16-row planter or this 24-row planter, maybe I should actually go back to a 16-row planter that's high speed because I can get more work done. So the idea of understanding efficiencies and the timeline you're trying to get things done, because timeliness plays a key factor in any yield, especially around planting time, whether you're spraying for herbicides or whether you're going out and harvesting that crop. Timeliness is a big factor here, and I think understanding how your farm performs during those different times of the years is a key component of that.
That must be some of his premier crop background coming out.
And I would argue that, so I don't know that the window has actually gotten smaller, like as far as weather. I think it data-driven analytics and agronomics that, you know, you have seen has driven that window smaller, because we're optimizing. We know when the optimum time is to get these things done, driven by data. So we know that. That's why the window is smaller, not because, you know, weather or anything like that. Maybe something has to do with that. But
so the cool part when we were preparing for this show, TJ, is you shared with me an article that you were working on. I don't know if it's published yet, but it's got some really good data in there that we're going to share with our listeners before anybody else can see this. So exclusive. Tell us a little bit about what you are working on.
Yeah, and it's maybe this provides a great opportunity to actually release it. But the idea was, I talked to a lot of farmers, and they were going through this decision process of purchasing a new combine, or new to them combine, I'll say, for this example. And so one of the things is you got to start to understand where you're starting from. So let's say for the purpose of this example, you know, I've got a John Deere S670 with about 1,800 separator hours. So I've been using it pretty heavily the last 5 to 7 years because guess what? Like, it didn't make sense to upgrade that combine. We'll also assume this is roughly an 1,800 acre farm, which means you're putting on about 200 to 215 separator hours a year. And so as we go through understanding what the key factors are in making this decision, this kind of just helps provide a baseline and an example as we walk through it.
Yep. Perfect. In your article, you kind of outlined 4, 5, 6 different items that you think are key when looking at potentially making a trade. So that's what you're doing in this situation, correct? Just trading one combine for the next?
Yeah, you're trading one combine for the next. The first piece of that puzzle is kind of around usage. So how long do you think you're going to keep that combine for? Because you want to project out how many hours you're going to add to that machine. If your listeners walk away from one thing from this podcast, it's that dollars per separator hour is the biggest determining factor in the value of that combine. And so, you know, you're seeing some high numbers for some low-hour, you know, 5, 10-year-old machines, I'm sure that David can talk to, but that's because the hours are so low. And one of the biggest factors in determining the value of a combine is the number of hours that it has, and you depreciate it in accelerating. The first 300, 400, 500 hours depreciate much faster than the next 500, and we'll kind of walk through that.
So you're talking about making a decision to upgrade, and correct, we're making, we'll use Corey as an example. Family's making a decision, hey, we have 2 years left on the combine, we need to make the decision of when to upgrade and what we're going to upgrade to. So we start looking ahead because we're good planners, and we know that hours are going to play into it. So we know how many acres we farm, and we got some data-driven decisions on the background to know that, hey, we're going to put this many more hours on it. But I would argue there's a time, like Tanner just traded his traded a vehicle off because the trade-in value was so good. If we knew that combines with our separator hours that we had to give right now were bringing more than what they would 2 years from now when we put an extra, you know, let's say 700-800 more hours on it, maybe the time to go is now. But how do we know that?
Yeah, and I think one thing you've got to start to do is to start analyzing your options, which I think is exactly what you're alluding to. So let's say I'm looking at an S770, right? Because I want to go to the newer model. For example's sake, let's say that there's an S770 with 300 hours on it, and then there's an S770 with 600 hours on it. Again, as we work through this, you'll start to understand the difference 300 hours can make on the overall depreciation of that machine. But then the other thing is, hey, you know what? There are S670s out there with 600, 700, 800 hours out there. Believe it or not, they do exist. So maybe one option is we actually stay with the same model and just basically
less wear.
Yeah, and I think as we work through some of the numbers, you'll start to see, hey, maybe that's not so bad of an idea. The caveat I will say, though, is that as technology continues to improve, when there's a step change in technology like combine automation or different things like that, that needs to play into this decision too. So it's not just about the older machine or depreciation. There are reasons from a technology standpoint to move forward.
Yeah, we've had conversations with Chad Colby before.
Yep.
And he's really pointed that out, whether it's in planter technology or in combines, that he really made it really clear that you're getting the same capacity but more efficiency. There's those little things that are changing, which I see could make a big difference, Dave.
Yeah, definitely. I would even think, too, as I know, I use your guys' software to look at comp results. Sometimes different states have different prices, different buyer groups. So if you're that person that's looking to just get less wear on your combine but have the same combine, you might even look outside your state, and it might be worth the hauling and trucking.
You might. One thing that I'll say in those first 50 conversations I had with farmers, I think 49 said they would prefer to work with their local equipment dealer to make that decision. And yep. So we just did a survey actually with successful farming, some good results within that. But 65% of farmers are starting that search online, and 19% are starting it at an equipment dealer. Hmm. And then somewhere around, I believe it was 13% are still looking at print.
So is it that that's actually a pretty small number, but the 40, you said 49 out of 50 said they wanted to work with their local dealer. Is that for fear that they're not going to get the same service on that machine if they bought it outside of the territory?
That's the number one fear by far. So
is that a fact or just a fear?
Ooh, that's a great question. So I've also been talking to quite a few equipment dealers, and I think it's a little bit of both, and I feel like I'm ducking your question. But because there are many people that in that same situation, if we buy that tractor, I want to work with somebody locally to get it fixed in season. And I think it's a little bit of both. I think if you're a good customer and your parts and service are a very profitable part of an equipment dealership, but the preference is to stay local. I want to make sure that that's kind of clear from what I've learned, is yeah. that preference is still there.
I think if you have a good relationship with your dealer, I mean, I've bought not to the scale of combines, but even skid loaders, and I've even brought the outside skid loader in that I said, hey guys, I found this in Kansas. Now I know I want to buy one from you, but this is literally $20,000 cheaper. So what do you think? Well, if I was you, I'd buy it, they said. And, I bought it, brought it back. I made sure to bring it back to them first, have them run through it
sure.
to establish the relationship that, hey, this is no longer Kansas. This is yours right. locally. And then we were able to solve it.
And we've done the same thing. And most recently with a track tractor this spring, went out of state, went to Nebraska to a different deer dealer. Our dealer, we gave them as many chances as we could. They just didn't have the tractor that mm-hmm, we wanted mm-hmm. for the price, and we could literally go get more tractor for less money. So I still haven't found out why. It's like in the back of your mind, what's wrong with this thing?
Sure,
But I do know people that work internally at our local dealer as well, and they make their money on parts and service.
Yeah,
right. So I'm not trying to go around them. I'm trying to be the best business person as a farmer, like get the best. Mm-hmm. vehicle tool for my job, but I'm also giving them the service. So I think they should be happy that we're staying the same color, the same,
Sure.
Right?
So I was just going to say, we're jumping so far ahead into the stuff we're going to talk about, but I think you did a good job of at least trying to get us back on topic. So we started off with usage for this machine. We need right. to know what we are going to do with ours if we don't get rid of it in the next 2 years, and what are we going to put on this machine and its useful life on our farm. So that was the first key, is you got to figure out what the appetite is, and that might help you determine if you're just going to add a machine versus trade one in.
Correct.
When you're looking at things. And then Dave just touched on it. The next item you brought up, TJ, was current market value, and how do you establish that? So it could be trade in, could be private sale, could be wholesale auction. It could go a lot of ways there too, but then you got into a couple of expense line items in that article. One of them was interest, and one of them was repairs. So explain a little bit more why that matters.
So interest is going to play a huge role in this decision process too. And Tanner, as the banker, I'm sure you've got the best rate around. But one thing that I assumed for this example is about a 3.5% interest rate. The higher the cost of the machine, holding that trade-in value constant, the more interest expense you're going to occur. And I think it's important because there is some difference here between the 300-hour machine versus the 600-hour machine versus that S670 I talked about with really low hours. And then the next thing is really around expected repairs. So this is the one that always, always comes up, right? Because if I'm going to a newer machine, I should expect lower repair costs.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair, Corey?
Yeah, that's fair.
One of the other things that you'll notice, and I kind of have this Ag Decision Maker article, which is the best resource out there, and it's a little dated, but one of the things you can start to do is project out repair costs. And so the more hours you add to the machine, you're going to see that curve go up at an increasing rate. And so The good thing is Iowa State has some good materials out there, and you can start to project out repair costs. And it's not a known. You don't know that for sure, but given all else equal, this is the best thing I can use to start to expect repairs and to project that out. So what I also did for this example is also project the repairs out for keeping my current combine, right? Because it's starting to get more and more hours on it.
Yep.
You can notice that when we walk through this, that S770 with low hours, you know, we could expect anywhere from $19,000 to $20,000 worth of repairs versus on the other extreme, that S670, if we keep it with 1,800 hours and add another 1,000 hours, you're adding about $65,000. So you start to see this trade-off start to happen between interest, repairs, and then eventually fuel is another one we can talk to.
Tanner, do you go over stuff like that with your clients when you're doing, I mean, I we had the podcast there, everybody we found out is afraid of bankers because it's the conversation they don't want to have. This might allude to a reason they should go talk with the bankers, but with a banker, because you're probably a resource that can help them make those decisions. It's not all bad stuff that you might find. You might find a loophole, not a loophole, but a discrepancy in, hey, maybe you should buy a new combine because look at your repair cost.
Yeah, there's no two conversations are the same, but I had one yesterday with a client that came in saying they wanted to look at trading grain carts. And by the end of the conversation, the trade from a 750 up to a 1,000 became, maybe we should look for a second 750.
Oh.
So they didn't even know that the way the conversation was going to go with their banker is, we're going to keep what we have and get an additional one. When they explained to me what their bottlenecks were, they really needed a second cart and not just one that was one step larger. So a lot of different things can come out of that, and some of those are what the potential repairs are. Because obviously, if that existing grain cart's worn out and shot, we need to move it down. But it's in good condition. They were just looking for potential more capacity. So yeah, a lot of conversations to me have with your banker. The fuel point that you brought up, TJ, I think is interesting, because along with fuel and newer technology comes death. Yeah, just everybody in the room just.
But and I think Tanner, you pointed it out. But in this example, right? I think if you were to go to an equipment dealer, the S770 has 15% more fuel efficient than an S670. I don't know that for sure. I'm taking their word for it. But you start to project that out, because another argument I'll hear is, well, the newer machine is more fuel efficient. I can expect less downtime. We're kind of working through all these things on the checklist, and then that kind of leads us to what the actual fundamental biggest cost of the whole thing is, and it's actual depreciation. Mm-hmm. It's not depreciation for tax reasons. It's not depreciation for my banker, which is usually pretty conservative. It's actual depreciation. So what is this thing going to be worth, or likely to be worth, in the next 5 years when I go to sell it? And this is the biggest line item of this whole thing. And that's where it goes back to the one thing I said earlier, dollars per separator hours. As you add more separator hours, you're going to add more depreciation to that machine, and you're going to incur the most depreciation in the first 600 hours of that machine.
And this is one of those factors as a banker. This is where I have customers that come in and they look at the neighbor and they go, I don't understand how this guy can trade sprayers every 3 years. Or I don't understand how they can upgrade their equipment. And it's every farm is different. I'm not saying there's a right way or the wrong way, but if they got into a position to where they found a niche that maybe sprayers are really good right at that 1,000-hour mark, or maybe I get really good value out of them if I stay under 900 hours, whichever it is, I could see where this is a huge factor in trading this off. Because if I've got a 4440 with 10,000 hours on it, I might as well keep it around a yard.
Those depreciate up.
They do. They right? depreciate
they
up.
They appreciate.
Appreciate.
Appreciate. Yeah.
That's a good point. I like that. You covered a lot of things. So just a real quick recap, because we're going to have a lot today. Usage matters. Current market value matters. Paying attention to the expense columns. That's interest, repairs, and fuel. And then what the actual depreciation is when looking at trading a machine from one to the next, whether we're going to upgrade in technology or we're going to go straight across models, we look at that. But our listener also wanted to know about leasing as options. So we just looked at trading. What about leasing?
Yeah, so this is, I spent a lot of time the last 3 days, of last week diving into leasing. Had a farmer in Eastern Iowa actually reach out to me to walk through this. So perfect timing for the podcast and perfect timing for me to learn. But one of the things you have to understand in the lease too is what are you looking at doing? So I'm going to use this as an example. Every example is a little bit different, but let's say I'm going to look at a new piece of equipment. And let's say that new piece of equipment is going to be roughly $585,000, which is not a small number. But then let's say they're willing to give me about $250,000 for my current machine. Okay. And so let's say we're comparing sprayers here for this example. And so what you've got to understand is that starting point. And then you start to work through the advantages of leasing versus buying, and we can obviously talk to that, but understand exactly what that piece of equipment are. What are the terms they're offering you if you were to buy it outright or if you were to actually lease it? And typically they're going to have a fair market value on that piece of equipment at the end of the lease. Mm-hmm. So everything that goes into it, hours you're adding to the machine, term of the lease, et cetera, are all going to play into this decision.
Yeah, that's a good point. I want to point that out right away, is not every lease is built the same way. And I don't want to say that it's the snake oil of the equipment dealership salesman tactics, but it certainly seems like the method that is used to help get operations into equipment that they couldn't regularly afford. There is a smart way to lease, in my opinion. That's my banker hat on right now. But it does seem like it's one of those that helps out on the cash flow front, because they typically have a lower payment up front and allow you to pay for that equipment over a longer period of time.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the custom guys maybe get into the leasing. The guys that know they have a set amount of hours that are spreading, you know, things or applying things, they can get into new equipment. They have their direct cost per hour that they already know that, right? Like, and it just seems a lot more straightforward, but I don't know. That's a big question to me.
Do you think there is a... we just had someone on the podcast that we were talking about price per farm, price per acre. I heard a guy say the other day that if you're not farming 1,000 acres, you're probably not farming enough to make a full-time living at farming. Do you at Tractor Zoom, is there like a dollar per acre that you, amount of acres rather, that it's better to lease than it's better to buy?
So I'll answer my banker, and then I'll have you jump in, TJ. But my banker answer is no. I look at a machinery cost per acre.
Mm-hmm. And if
your machinery cost per acre is made up of one lease payment and three loan payments, or one lease payment and repair bills, or a combination of all of that, that's all I care about, is can your farm support $150 an acre? Can it only support $75 an acre?
But it also matters, is the ground paid for?
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Right? Or are you renting?
Yep.
I mean, so well, and I was thinking a time factor. So newer equipment, more acres. Let's say you rent and farm 10,000 acres. Well, now there's a time factor in there. We don't have downtime at all. We can't have downtime at all. So what is the time worth in leasing it? Maybe we just lease every year for the time.
So I think you're going to hit a couple of the benefits that I had in leasing. So if we kind of stick along the same pattern here, is we started off with budget or cash flow. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one way to start. But now use. You know, you had talked about usage on a machine. If we know we need a tractor that has 300 horsepower for 600 hours a year, because it's going to do a specific task. That's our field cultivator and fall tillage tractor. Well, there could be a lease structure that fits a 600-hour need, and then you don't have to worry about having any residual payment for owning it. You can only pay for what you use and roll that tractor in a 3 or 5 year plan, whatever it looks like. So you could match up how many hours you're going to use. You talked about a custom guy. I know a lot of custom operations that charge by the hour. You get into silage chopping, and it's so many dollars per hour for the chopper that's running, the trucks that are running, the tractor that's packing. So if you know that you're going to charge $100 an hour for this tractor and you could lease it for $50, you've got a built-in margin. So sometimes it's easier on the billing side as far as usage goes. But
yep. When you get to your hours, then you just do another one.
Yep.
Right.
Tanner, what about everybody? What about mechanics? So we know farmers that have hired mechanic just literally to service their equipment all the time. If you were to lease and it goes back to the shop every year as part of the lease agreement, do you eliminate that income that you had to pay out as a wage in farm mechanic?
I would argue that it's probably still going to be a necessity, but you just hit on a good point, because sometimes when you lease newer equipment, or leasing allows you to get into a newer piece of equipment, it comes with a warranty.
Mm-hmm.
So we can throw a warranty package into this. For example, if we're going to stay green, now we've got PowerGuard included. And that probably goes a long ways. Now, TJ, when you look at leases and the market value at the end of this and your actual depreciation research that you've done, have you had any comparison? Does that seem to be pretty close? Or how should we look at that if we're approached with a leased option?
So the way I like to look at it is kind of apples to apples. So if they're giving me a fair market value, we should also look at what we think it might be based on real data. But when we're walking through this example, what's interesting is one of the biggest costs that we haven't talked about yet is just the discount on the present value of your money. So this goes back to finance class in college, but it's critically important. So if you think, for example, historically, you could make 7% in the stock market with that same cash, and then you assume 3% inflation, that discount for present value is about 10%. You have to multiply those numbers together. Well, guess what we have going on right now? Inflation.
Yep.
So now you take that 5-6%, whatever you think that number is going to be at the end of this year, and add it to whatever you think you could make with that money. If it's 5-6%, that number just went way up. So what's interesting right now is that inflation is actually playing a key role in this decision. I'll give you an example. Have a farmer that went into a lease 3 years ago, right? And before we experienced what we're experiencing today. And so they had a fair market value buyout at the end of that of, let's say they said 3 years ago it was going to be $250,000. Well, they can sell that same tractor today for $300,000. Now that is not the normal. I'm not right. going to sit on here right. and say that, but that is part of what can happen in these scenarios. Typically expect the depreciation to happen though.
Right. So it would just be the opposite. So if the buyout's 250, mm-hmm. it's only worth 200. The instance you would then have to make a business decision as the farmer to walk away from that and move into another either buying or leasing scenario, because there's no sense in buying something for $250,000 at the end of this agreement that's only worth $200.
Correct.
Unless for some reason you fell in love with this piece of equipment and wanted to keep it around. But that, again, that's an emotional decision and not a business one.
So if Tanner would just give me an operating loan to put into the stock market, 7%. we should be good.
The final thing though is, like, and I'm not a CPA. You guys should have somebody on, because with what's expected to happen this year with some of the income, taxes play the biggest role. So I built this calculator. I'm working on it. Need a CPA to review it. But the biggest factor actually probably is your tax implications at the end of the year for your Section 179.
Yeah, that's a good point, because the lease payment is the whole payment's fully deductible.
Correct.
But that's all you can deduct, to my knowledge. If you own the equipment, you don't have to worry about the loan payment. You now are basing your depreciation schedule on your accountant's suggestions, whether you're going to accelerate that or take it over a period of time.
Are they keeping the 179 deduction in the new tax plan? Because I thought they were taking it away.
That's where he was going with his, it yeah. may not be here.
So. But this is where it's going to be critical to be talking to your accountant, because I assume, so I talked to some of the largest equipment dealers in the country over the last couple weeks, and they believe this will be the biggest December and January they've ever had. So what that tells me is a lot of these decisions are being made that we're talking about
based on taxes.
Based on taxes.
Yep.
So I cannot speak to that. You all that are listening.
Farmland's the same way. Everybody's trying to sell before the end of the year because they don't think they're going to roll back the tax plan.
Yep. So the other thing that I noted about leasing equipment is a technology need. So one of the things that happened in the most recent last 5 or 6 years is the planter technology required different or additional capacity on the tractor side of things. So whether you're going from a low speed to a high speed planter that needs more horsepower, or you're going sub-inch as far as your GPS is set up, the lease option could be a way for you to get into the latest technology without hurting your pocketbook so much. So what I've got, unless anybody else has more on the lease side, is a couple of the negatives is you're not truly building equity. It's probably going to be more rare than it is an opportunity to build equity when you hit inflation, and you don't get to take advantage of the depreciation schedule, but do get to fully expense that lease payment to your farm. The positives is it's really a balance sheet helper. If you think about debt to equity ratio, leases don't show up on a balance sheet. They're an expense sheet item. So you don't have that tractor on your balance sheet. So if you're an over-leveraged farmer, you may be able to get rid of that over-leveraged piece of equipment, roll into a lease, and it does help your ratios, which may help you on an interest rate side or an approval side. I'm not saying that's the way to go, but it's a fact. Also helps out on the cash flow, because typically those payments are a little bit less. If you think about it as a hedge, you could potentially be hedging against equipment values and where we're going to see depreciation in the next couple of years. It'd be interesting to look at those sides of things. So that's what we've got. We've now done trading, and we've now done looking at a lease for Andrew. So what about comparing this to custom farming, Corey? And I know you've got a little bit of experience on a custom farming side. Remind our listeners what type of custom farming you and your family do.
Yeah, I mean, there's several ways you can custom farm, but the way we do it is basically a full service. So we don't own the land. We rent some land, but then there's another option where we just custom farm it. We do everything from tillage to spraying, planting, harvesting, hauling the grain, full service to wherever they decide to go to market. So, and that's a rate set by the ISU custom average they put out every year, and rates are determined on that. And so just like a gun for hire, I guess it's it doesn't have the upside of potentially marketing your own grain, storing it yourself, doing that kind of stuff, but it provides stability. And, you know, you can really pencil out the numbers every year. Helps make equipment payments.
So is there anything that can't be done custom?
As in legal?
No, on the farming side of things. Like the way you describe that is, it sounds like if I am the land owner or I am the farmer, I don't have to own equipment. I could hire somebody else to do everything.
Absolutely.
I've considered doing it.
And you could maybe just own the planter. Maybe you like planting. You could plant the crop, and then someone else can spray it and harvest it. Maybe you like harvesting. You buy an old combine. You like that. You own a couple hundred acres. You know, you're not pushed for time. And someone else goes and does that. Because, you know, some of these planters are $300,000.
Yeah.
You know, with all the technology. And you want that technology. You don't want to go, you know, a John Deere 7000 planter is a good planter, but it doesn't have downforce, it doesn't have the electric drives or the high speed options. So you could potentially be raising a 250 bushel per acre corn crop opposed to your 200 bushel per acre corn crop, but then you like to harvest it.
That's where you got to do that math, though. I say it all the time, money's made in the margins, because there's an old boy next to me that still uses old equipment, paid off ground, 1586 tractor. I mean, lots of hours, but he might not be getting much yield, but I tell you what, he has a lot less money input into it. Mm-hmm. But what you were just talking about with custom hire, Tanner and I were talking about this the other day, because I was thinking about buying some farm ground. I think the custom hire might even work more effectively for the smaller guys if you only have that 160 acres. And, you know, it's a lot of money to buy all the equipment that you need to buy to make a farm go. So, like you said, maybe I just like planting, so I just buy that and then hire everything else.
Or you think that planting's the most important.
Yeah.
And you can do it at the right time without relying on somebody else. And I think that's where Andrew, our guest or our listener that made the suggestion here of trying to compare the two, is let's look at the cost. Let's do a quick little rundown here on potentially weighing the cost of buying a piece of equipment versus having it custom hired. What do you think, Corey?
Yeah. I will say, on the backside of that, if you're the land owner, there are some tax advantages as well to being in charge and making the decisions, because you're actively involved in farming. So there's some tax benefits. I can't explain exactly what they are, but I know there is.
One of them is state tax. If you go to sell, I'll just tell you right now that if you're a materially participating member, if you go to sell that land, you can avoid the capital gain on state, but you have to be a material participating member. So that custom hire could put you in that category.
Renting kicks you out. But you could crop share.
Yep. So if you are a person that moves land a lot or flips, or you're just using it as a commodity to buy the next one as investment, you might want to.
Or if you are the farmer and you know somebody that does that,
that's right.
This is another pitch for you to potentially get a larger custom portfolio to put that together. But let's stick to combines for Andrew's sake. We have to compare all the costs. So if you think about that, it's more than just sticker price when purchasing a combine. We talked about all the things that come along, especially with depreciation, but you've got maintenance, fuel, all your fluids, support equipment. So you also have to have a corn head, a bean head, a head trailer, probably something to get rid of the grain, because very rarely are you going to have a good opportunity to combine and dump into somebody else's semi or wagons for them to wait. So maybe it's a grain cart. There's support things. I mean, if you're thinking a sprayer, you're going to need storage, tender, pumps, everything that goes along with that. And then also think about licenses and certification, because I got to thinking about custom manure application. Mm-hmm. Not just anybody can go out and do that and apply it. So there may be additional cost to that. Also, let's think about your cash flow needs. This is the banker hat I'll back here on again. So this might be a negative towards custom farming. If you get all your cash flow after that crop is sold in the fall and you don't have access to capital during the year. Corey, when you spray, do you expect to be paid when you get done spraying?
Within a reasonable amount of time.
But before the crop is harvested, correct?
Yeah.
So there has to be access to capital or cash flow during the year if you're going to hire someone to custom perform this task. So if we're thinking about not buying a sprayer and instead having it custom hired, we have to make sure that our cash flow is set up to pay for that in season. Mm-hmm. Does owning that sprayer or combine allow for you to make that payment when it better fits your cash flow position?
On the owning side of it, I would say, you know, say we farm 1,000 acres and we do 500 custom. You know, we probably at 1,000 acres couldn't really justify having a self-propelled sprayer. But 1,500, maybe there's a split there. So it's almost leveraging someone else's acres. And it's sometimes just a cost neutral, but it allows us to have a better piece of equipment for our 1,000 acres.
Mm-hmm. And I think on the spraying side specifically, right, when you are spraying your own acres, you have a little bit more leverage when you're looking at buying those inputs, right?
Absolutely.
So we talk about the cost of $6 an acre to custom hire it out. But most of the time when you're spraying or running over that field multiple times with that sprayer, you're also able to have a little bit more leverage when you're purchasing those inputs, and that's where the money's really made.
It's a really big number, I mean, actually. I mean, from what we've seen.
Yep. And then Dave kind of alluded to the workload. Do you physically have the time available to perform this task? Mm-hmm. Are you working a 9-to-5 and only have weekends and nights to do this, or vacation time? Are you already maxed out on acres without hiring? Do you not have an extra tractor to put on this machine? Do you, you know, you got to think about the workload, or can you actually afford the size of equipment that you need? When Dave and I were talking, is sure, if you wanted to farm 1,000 acres with a 6-row planter, have at it.
You could do it.
But if that's all you could afford, maybe you're better off being more efficient with having that custom done. I don't know, that's an extreme example. But that comes in there. Well,
it brings back your windows, right? Are you going to be able to get with the 1,000 acres with your 6-row planter in the optimum window? Probably not.
I have a funny example. I was working with a farm, and they always planted beans after corn, right? Which is common, and now that's switched. But anyways, they had a 15-foot drill they were running, and I was like, hey, we have two 90-foot planters. If we plant the field twice, this sounds crazy. If we plant the field twice and offset it 15 inches, we get the yield gain from the 15-inch rows, plus we get it done 3 times faster. And I remember telling this farm this, and they did it, saw the gains that we saw in the data. And then what's funny is we're going up the road to another farm I was working with, and they thought it was the craziest thing they had ever heard of, that the farmer was planting the field twice. And it's because the data actually suggested to do this because they had a big enough planter to do it. So sometimes you got to think about that window. You obviously have to always consider the agronomic benefits of whatever you're doing, because yield is the biggest driver down of cost per bushel of anything you will do. Now, you can't just keep spending to infinity, but yield always wins in this. And so understanding your efficiencies and the agronomic gains that you have make this a really smart decision when you're thinking about equipment. It can't be emotional. It can't be this or that. What are the gains you think you can have? And then let's put the pencil to it and let's make the right decision.
I like that, because now it comes to quality, and we've talked about this. You've complimented your dad on multiple occasions that you feel like he's the best sprayer operator in the area for attention to detail and not running corn down, not running crop over. If you don't have the skill as an operator to stay in the rows or to actually do the best job, or you don't have access to good operators in your area, that could help weigh the decision on whether you buy, lease, or hire someone custom to perform that task. Mm-hmm. The negatives to this, custom farming is typically it's out of your control for timing. You're usually at the mercy of the operator that you're hiring to do this. If you find a good operator, you can have a little bit more persuasion, or if you have volume, you can have persuasion. But if you have cut up 13-acre parcels and you're wanting someone to come in there and spray that for you, you're probably not top on their list. Would you agree?
The two that I see that are just the absolute worst, and it's not the operator's fault, is manure and seed corn, because they have a bunch of acres to get over. So if it rains 2 inches, you and I would probably stay out of the field. But someone else is telling them they got to get on down to the road to the next one because they're next in line. And they got to get their manure pump. They got to get their seed corn out. The company's wanting their corn. And so they tear it up.
Yep.
And it is ugly. And there's no disking or deep tilling that's going to put that back the way it was for a long time.
The other negative is that cash flow timing. It's usually an in-season task that has an in-season bill. But the positives are is typically that bill is less than the actual cost of ownership. So that operator is spreading the cost of that machine and their time over a lot more acres, which more than likely, Dave, like you talked about, is going to allow them to afford newer technology and more capacity. But the last one that our listener, Andrew, didn't bring up in his email that I thought was kind of interesting is, what about joint ownership? Do you, Corey or Dave, have any experience on joint ownership of equipment, whether that's amongst partnerships or exchanging services or anything that goes along those lines of sharing equipment?
I do. Go ahead. You?
A lot of smaller stuff we will share with, you know, just some little dirt graders and things like that, but I could see it on a larger scale as well.
Yeah, and I'm small time, but I shared a hay equipment with a neighbor who we were going to share hay equipment. There's only one problem. We both want to use it on the same day when it's not raining. And so we realized our flaw very quickly, and it ended up that one, it worked out when we split labor to where I would always mow, he would always rake, and we just do both fields together.
All go at the same time.
But if that other person has a different schedule than you have, it's just not going to work. Eventually, we dissolved the partnership, and one bought the other one out, and then the other bought their own. But it was good to save money when we did it.
So there was a program, and I cannot remember the name of the company right now, that used to kind of allow you to rent other farmers' equipment. Like if you were a combine in the wheat country and you got done with wheat, but then we were getting ready to do corn in Iowa, that might be a way to get a combine, and you almost split and shared. I know that fell through, so obviously that scenario doesn't work out very well, at least as a business goes. But I've seen it to where guys that have hog barns will share a manure tank. Mm-hmm. At the time, they also share labor because they're going to go and haul and empty these barns all at one time, pumps, tanks, get it out, get it done. Some have transfer over the road. My dad, I grew up with, was always sharing our ripper. That was a little bit of a touchy deal because same thing. One wanted to be ripping right away behind the combine. The other one have to wait and do it all in a big chunk of acres. But I could see this working. I mean, if you've got feed yards where one's always doing silage and the other one's doing earlage, those are two different times a year. It could be a harvest setup with grain cart and transportation equipment versus the combine. Just got to be the right person, because there's a lot of partnerships, as we explored in some of our previous episodes, that don't end very well.
No, it's good when it's good. It's bad when it's bad.
I thought of one. There is one. Several farms are sharing a sprayer.
Oh, yeah.
There's another good example. One that comes up the most common that I'll tie the last two together actually for you guys is probably one that your listeners experience the most, is a father-son. So as the dad, like, you know, is nearing retirement, who knows if they'll ever retire, but they're not going to buy a new piece of equipment, right? So that new piece phases out. Let's say, you know, the younger generation buys that next piece, right? And then charges custom rate to the dad. And that's their way to start building equity and charging at the same time. Because all of a sudden, you can't end up at the end of this and having to buy $1 million worth of equipment. It's a smarter way to phase these pieces of equipment out as they're aging out. Let that younger generation come in, buy that new piece, and then charge custom rate to dad back, which is income. And now that helps for a lot of tax reasons. Again, I'm not a tax professional, but the idea is that you're phasing out and transferring equity smarter than trying to do that all in one big thing. Or, hey, I'm going to buy out dad over 5 years. Let's step this back and let's do it with a piece of equipment and let's make the right decision.
I like that.
I've seen that. And I think that's how the younger farmer that listens to our podcast makes a go of it. You know, you said that you wanted to farm, and the next best thing you could do, because you couldn't farm, was work with farmers, especially living in a college town here. I hear people all the time, well, I'm going to be a farmer. Well, the amount of money that costs, Tanner, that I don't think you can lend them at their balance sheet,
right,
is have a partner.
So TJ alluded to it right away in the beginning, is the Ag Decision Maker through Iowa State University. I'm going to put that link in our show notes, because they have a chart that does a really good job of comparing the difference between ownership, whether you purchased it with cash or had to finance it, custom hiring, renting short term, so if you just rented from the neighbor for a season, versus long term leases, or different financing plans. So they put that all in there, and they kind of lay out the difference between when your capital outlay is, what your cash flow needs are, what repairs might be your expense to manage versus somebody else's, how it plays to the tax code, what your labor looks like and required out of this. And then again, the risk. So it's kind of really nice there. And that might be something that could help Andrew out and everybody else that has the same considerations is these universities have a lot of research done that do exactly what we talked about in this episode today. But the biggest thing I want to pass along is what works for one piece can't be the end all be all for every decision. If you made a choice on renting a combine or custom hiring your harvest done, doesn't mean that's right for upgrading tractors on the planter.
Tanner, Corey, here's my thought for the day. As I've been involved in agriculture in one way, shape, or form, and as we've done this podcast together and asked lots of questions to lots of people, you know, some people say planting is the most important. Some people say the biologics are the most important. Some people say that your harvest equipment has got to be up to date. There's a heck of a lot, almost to the point of saying a hell of a lot of decisions that a farmer has to make. And Tanner, we always talk about being profitable. And man, there's a lot of different decisions that you could go one way or another. From the outside looking in, I'm like, okay, how do we decide what's the most important on our farm? And then we're trying to weigh the relationships of father-son and buying more and equity and banks and forecasting. And, you know, there is a lot more decisions if you are not a farmer that listens to this podcast than you can ever imagine.
I agree. And so before we wrap up here, TJ, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners on this topic before I try to summarize everything we just chatted about?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing takeaway I have is that there is enough data to help make a directionally right decision. You're not going to be able to be perfect, right? Like, no one could predict 3 years ago that we'd be in the position that we are today with, you know, it's really hard to find a row crop tractor. No one would have predicted that 3 years ago. But at the same time, you also have to understand that if you're in the business of farming, you're likely going to be farming in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So you can't let recency bias kind of overtake some of the decision making. And I see that a lot. You know, I talk to a farmer, you know, always buys new because, you know, there was one time they bought used and they had to replace an engine. And that sticks in their head. Mm-hmm. And versus the numbers would tell them over and over again, but they're not going to do that because they had that one bad experience. So don't let recency bias kind of cloud those decisions. And let's put together the numbers, because I do believe when it comes to machinery decisions, there is enough information out there to be directionally right most of the time.
Very well said.
So do you have the golden nuggets? Can you tell us the golden nuggets? What is the right hour on the combine?
I think you're gonna see that we're gonna keep working on things to help find that. I mean, you can tell in dollars per separator hour that, you know, up at that first 600, you're gonna incur a lot of depreciation. Tractors, it depends on horsepower. Do you have tracks? Is it red? Is it green?
Each piece has a tipping point.
They do typically with engines, right? Yep. Planters just are a unique beast because of all the new technology that you can add to them. But with engines, you can typically start to see over time where the most profitable decisions can be made, for sure.
And that's data that our listeners can get through TractorZoom.
That's correct. And you know, I mean, you know, if there's anybody listening out here that wants to walk through a lease analysis or a purchase decision, this is what I'm trying to learn about. And before we ever build anything or do anything, we kind of do it the hard way. And we try to learn, okay, where's the biggest pain point? And what I do know is that the biggest pain point farmers have is knowing what their equipment's worth and negotiating over that purchase decision. And so I think you'll see us continue down that path of trying to listen to farmers and understand where we might be able to help.
So if they do want to get a hold of you, you're at AgTechTed on Twitter, but how else can they get a hold of you?
You know, they can email me. It's tmasker, M-A-S-K-E-R @tractorzoom.com. And even Twitter is probably the best place to get a hold of me. You can shoot me a message in my DMs or wherever you want. But I love talking to farmers and I love diving into the issues that they're facing and the problems they're trying to solve. Because if you have an issue or you're trying to figure it out like Andrew is, chances are there's 50, 100, 1,000 other farmers doing the same thing. So how can we start to understand how we can help?
Yeah. I like that. And you know the question we ask everybody, what do the most successful farmers all have in common? Be thinking about that while I try to summarize, because we covered a ton during this episode. So we started off with looking at upgrading. So what does it look like to trade? What can we consider when we're doing our trade? Well, look at the usage of the machine that we have and what our needs are over the next couple of years, what that's going to do to the value, the current market value of our equipment, versus what we're looking at on the market front for buying a piece of equipment. Take a look at interest rates, what your expected repairs are, Are you going to gain any fuel efficiencies? Do you not like working with DEF? And what the actual depreciation is going to be on that piece of equipment. So that's key when you're looking at trading or adding to your fleet. If you're not looking at trading and are going to go the lease route, consider your budget. See what your use is. Do you have a set number of hours that you're going to use? Pay attention to those lease terms because they're going to have a buyout or an ending market value, and see how that compares to what you're going to do. Talk to your accountant. You're going to probably talk to your accountant a lot on these equipment deals to find out what your tax needs are and what you can do. Pay attention to your cash flow and the technology that you need to have available, because you could help out a lot of parts of your operation and balance sheet on putting things together. Now, when you compare owning and leasing to custom hire, there's all kinds of costs that go into this. We just talked about it. Maintenance, fuel, fluids, support equipment. Do you need any licenses or certifications in order to do this task? What are your cash flow needs? Can you make that custom payment in the middle of the year? Do you have the physical capacity with time and talent to take on that workload? Quality. Are you the best operator for the job? Can you find a better operator that can do this for you? Your bushel and yield loss, whether that comes from a combine or sprayer running over a crop or getting it planted timely, is going to be a major factor in making this decision. All that, and you need to find the data, whether that's through TractorZoom, Iowa State Ag Decision Maker, any of those resources that are out there. Use data and make that decision, because it's probably going to be different every single time. Did I miss anything, Corey?
I think that's good.
All right, TJ, what do the most successful farmers all have in common?
You know, I've had the luxury to work with and talk with a lot of farmers across the country.
Hold on. He just pointed at Corey. So Corey's got to be one of the most successful
farmers. Just the only farmer in the room.
Worked with one of
by
them.
Default.
All right. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I think as simple as this sounds, just a deep, deep curiosity, right? Trying to ask why. Like, why does this work and not this work? And I'm going to try this versus this. You know, you're running strip trials. Most farmers need 3 years to prove something on their farm, but that deep, deep curiosity helps you learn. And I always have this quote in the back of my head, and it's from a farmer in Southern Illinois, and I have it pulled up because I don't want to butcher it. But he told me, he goes, that's the thing about farming. You learn every year. Every year is different. Sometimes you can apply that knowledge the following year, but sometimes you might not be able to apply that for another 10 years. So always keep learning, always keep improving. And that's always stuck with me. And I think that plays back to that deep curiosity, because if you're not curious, you're not learning. And again, you may learn something this year that may not benefit you next year, but it may benefit you in 5 or 6 years. And I always go back to what that old farmer told me, because I think we can obviously learn a lot from the older generation and the farmers. And I think that plays back to that curiosity piece.
And you really got to work on curbing your recency bias. Like that. That hit home for me. Just because it was what worked last year or didn't work last year, or the last time you purchased a semi and it ended up being a lemon, doesn't mean that all used equipment is bad. So, Dave, did you happen to come up with a challenge for our listeners here based upon all these data-driven decisions?
I just, like I said earlier, there over the last few years, Tanner, doing this podcast, there are so many decisions to be made that can make you more profitable. And we ask that question every time, what is the most common trait? And I've heard it over and over again, just like I said, is they're always looking to improve or be better. So my challenge today is going to just challenge everybody to be better and improve, because we have found in 2 years, hundreds of ways to be more profitable on the farm. You just got to apply it.
Yep, you got to work and take a look at your operation. Corey, thanks for joining us on a Farm for Profit show. Listeners, thanks for sticking around with us. We like the ideas that you have. Continue to send those to farmforprofitllc@gmail.com. Like, rate, review, and share. It might be one of your reviews that gets sent out there. And thank you again to our partners, BW Fusion, Brandt, and Estes Concaves. We really appreciate the support. They care about the profitability of your farm, and that's why they put a portion of their profitability behind us. Until next time, have a good one.
Remember, if you aren't farming for profit, you won't be farming for long.
I got a couple for an after show.
Fire away.
So DEF. I was actually pretty impressed when we bought our tractor, 3,000-hour warranty on the DEF system. That gave me peace of mind. But what I'm worried about is, after that, like, what is that? Is this going to be a complete delete, delete, delete on this stuff? Or have you seen, what are you seeing with higher hour def equipment? Does it fall off faster?
That's a good question. It's not an attribute we're tracking, but you can obviously go to the year, make, and model, and you can start to figure that out. Like 2013
and
on. I've seen auction prices be very strong for those before def. So that to me is more of a leading indicator than anything.
So people want the non-def tractors.
I wonder if that isn't just because everybody's saying that. That is the echo throughout the community, you know, of, oh, I got, get, don't,
before I can tell you firsthand. I can tell you on my semi, like firsthand and my pickup, like, once those things, they're good for a while. Once they start having troubles, it's just one sensor after another, after a def heater, and all of a sudden, it's the same amount of money to fix it than it is to just delete it.
Well, did you see the Tony Reid rant on def the other day?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to let it run for another 10 minutes.
Well, it's just, how is that saving the environment? And then all the plastic jugs and all that. So I'm worried and interested to see what happens with these, because deleting it's easy. It just takes money. But the EPA and the government has all these fines that are fining the people that are doing it and making it hard to do that when it's just someone trying to run their business, right? They're just trying to make a living and be efficient. But, so I'm interested in that to track going forward. And also my next one is for Tony Reid. So you guys got to be tracking a metric of Goodyear tires versus non-Goodyear tires, right?
So what's interesting, there's actually a lot of data around how important it is to get that machine bought right and understanding the cost of the tires. So like, this is actually a very real concept and a very real thing that plays into the value of a piece of equipment. And we have some things we're learning in that regard, but it actually does make a pretty big difference on the purchase price of a piece of equipment.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, we had
Sloan.
Scott Sloan. We had him on, you know, Goodyear maker, Titan tire maker of Goodyear farm tires. But Tony Reid absolutely hates Goodyear tires.
And what did he say on his last podcast?
Good for
if you
year.
Gave him $100,000, he still wouldn't tell you that he liked him.
Goodyear could come to him and say they want to sponsor his podcast for 1 year for $100,000, and he wouldn't take it.